This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
Hello there, I'm Hayley Stevens and this is The Spooktator, a podcast which examines the stranger elements of life, society, international culture and the media. I'm joined by Charlie Revel-Smith and Paul Gannon.
Hello.
Hello everyone.
Hello. I don't know why I said it like that, I just felt like it and went with it, so.
Well, it's better than the sass you brought last time, I'll say that.
Thanks. You can find links to the things we discuss in this episode at www.spooktator.co.uk, where you will also find ways to contact us, subscribe to us, or follow us on social media if you should wish to. Guys, have you been up to anything interesting since the last episode?
Since we last recorded, I turned 41 and I've been crying ever since.
41? That's
old.
All right. Where is she going with this?
I remember once being late 20s and having a great time, and then where's it all gone?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Well, actually, by the time this is recorded, I turned 38.
Oh, I forgot that you guys have birthdays near each
other. Yeah, I think we're only a few days apart.
You can't be in our gang, Hayley.
That's fine. I really don't want to be.
You can be in it then.
Go on. What's wrong with our gang?
What's the name of the gang?
Birthday Boys.
Birthday
oh yes,
boy.
I would love to join the birthday boy gang. Yes,
it's more of a dance troupe than a gang, to be fair.
We could be the Virgos.
Although that does sound like a 70s folk band.
It does.
Or a group of people who like John Virgo from Big Break.
And who doesn't?
Well, Jim Davidson apparently.
Yeah, pretty much all of Britain since the end of Big Break. Where did he go?
I think he's still doing the snooker commentary. Anyway, should we start the episode? Because I've derailed it.
I was going to ask you what the Big Break was, but I feel like that would probably mean I can't be in the birthday boy gang.
It was like a snooker-themed Saturday night show, which ran for years.
Yeah. Imagine Bullseye, but with snooker.
And presented by a massive racist.
Sexist, horrible prick.
What's Bullseye? I'm kidding. Let's get on with the show.
So I've been watching a lot of documentaries recently. I like them. And I tend to keep my eye on trailers online for upcoming. And, you know, I can't wait for Hellier Series 2. Because the first series, apparently, I don't know if you heard this, was just The Symptom. So, sorry, whoever came up with that line really needs their head examined. Because it means nothing. It literally means nothing.
It's a load of goblin gook. Oh, no.
Goblin gook. Hashtag that. Anyway, regardless of that, a trailer appeared online recently for a documentary called Wrinkles the Clown. And I'd never heard of this story until the documentary, but apparently it's a thing. We've spoken in the past on the podcast about people dressing up as clowns to scare people.
Yeah.
And that whole phenomenon, was it like, what, 2 years ago? Something like that, where people just got into the habit of being pricks and dressing up as clowns and putting people...
It was 2016.
Yeah.
Wow. It was
the really major one.
And it's kind of been a thing ever since, sort of. Not as much now, I don't think, but yeah, it really took off for a little while.
So I'll just read this article from geek.com, which has a pretty decent overlay of what Wrinkles the Clown's about. So, Magnolia Pictures and Magnet are releasing a documentary. It's a chilling expose of how one man, whose identity remains unknown to this day, managed to become an online celebrity overnight and creep out people across the US. In late 2014, a video of a person in a clown mask sneaking up on a sleeping child appeared on YouTube. The video's description claimed that the clown, named Wrinkles, lived in Southwest Florida and was hired by the kid's parents to frighten her for badly behaving.
Wow.
The footage kickstarted Wrinkles' terrifying reign on the internet, and it went viral on the platform. More footage of Wrinkles started emerging online shortly after, in addition to a phone number to hire him for behavioural services. What? The real-life Pennywise became so popular on YouTube because kids were filming themselves calling and leaving messages for him and sharing their brave task with millions of viewers. The documentary aims to tackle a more challenging question, though. Who exactly is Wrinkles? Why did he opt out of a conventional clown job? And what makes the situation even eerier is the fact that Wrinkles has remained anonymous this entire time. And then the article goes on about how everyone's on about clowns now because of the Joker movie and the It movies and things like that. But ultimately, it's fascinating because it takes... In the documentary trailer, there's a line because they interviewed this guy and I think they hide his identity.
What, the clown?
Yeah. In the documentary, they have spoken to whoever is behind the mask in the Wrinkles clown thing. And there's a line he says in it saying, when he was a normal clown, no one ever hired him. And then this happened, and now the phone keeps on ringing. And so there's this interesting kind of... it's not like Slender Man, where the story became real through people's actions. This is more like an urban legend that has been created to be real in the first place.
Yeah.
So you've got basically a story of a guy who you can hire to come and scare you or your naughty kids. And there are clips in the documentary and in the trailer of kids phoning up, leaving a message, and then him calling back, leaving a scary message. And then, like, they see him in the garden at the end of, you know, through their window in their house. They can see him in the garden.
That's weird. Why would you call him?
It's the equivalent of, like, maybe saying Bloody Mary three times in a mirror.
Yeah, I was going to say it's the same sort of, like, sleepover dare that you do.
Yeah. Imagine having a bespoke service where you can have a spooky night out, where, you know, you can invite your friends over and go, let's call Wrinkles the clown. But the thing is, because no one knows who he is, he could be anyone, and that in itself is actually dangerous.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's a video clip in the trailer where you see a kid in his bedroom fast asleep, and I presume it's the original YouTube video, but he's fast asleep in his bed, and then the drawer underneath the bed, a storage thing, opens up, and Wrinkles the clown just gets up out of it.
No.
So it's all very paranormal, you know, black and white screen camera footage kind of stuff.
God, I can't wait to see this. This sounds fascinating.
So hang on. So does that mean that the child's parents let this stranger dressed as a clown into their home and he climbed underneath their child's bed and then they put their child to sleep above the stranger in their child's bed and then left the room?
Yeah, I think, I mean, without seeing the actual footage, without knowing the documentary, that's what it implies. Because someone must have let him in. I don't think they would have said, we're going to leave the keys under the mat. They're having a sleepover tonight. You can let yourself in before they get started and hide in the cupboard.
Unless the whole thing, you know, like with the YouTube videos, were faked to begin with.
Yeah.
Which is possible.
I really hope they were faked, because if that's real, that's questionable parenting. I mean,
I think that's child abuse, isn't it?
Letting a stranger under your child's bed, that's really questionable parenting.
Yeah, but just going out of your way to frighten your kids to that degree, when you're exposed to something that terrifying as a child, it can actually have lasting effects on you.
I suppose, though, there is a parallel, a sort of comparison to be made to Santa. If you're not good, you won't get any presents from Santa. And let's go and see the shopping mall Santa. And as a threat that he is real, you better be good.
But Father Christmas is ultimately is meant to be benign, though, isn't he? He is like a nice presence. But,
yeah.
And the
like
worst thing he does,
thing, I guess.
Yes, yeah. The worst thing Father Christmas does is not give you presents.
The worst thing Father Christmas does is shit down your chimney.
Well, where did you
get that? Okay, well. You were a bad girl one year, I take it. There's an interesting article on the wiki page which says in November 2015, there was an interview with the Washington Post with Wrinkles, and he claims to be a 65-year-old retired and divorced veteran who moved to Florida from Rhode Island. He was bored with being a boring retiree, so he bought a distinctive clown mask and started making stickers and business cards promoting his telephone number.
Oh my God.
And then it all went on from there.
This is how serial killers start. Like, this is bad.
It's fascinating because there's the immediate danger of hiring a stranger to do something to vulnerable children that you are in care of, potentially.
Yeah.
You know, and there's the story about teenagers creating an urban legend because kids love this shit.
Yeah.
Kids love telling ghost stories around the campfire, scaring each other, doing Bloody Mary, Halloween, trick or treating, going in the graveyard. kids like to push the boundaries. The problem is when something's real like this, like we all know Bloody Mary isn't going to attack you. We all know a Ouija board isn't going to summon a demon. There's all this stuff, but this is a real person you're calling.
Yeah, and I think it calls into question, really, who is behind it. If it is just one person, I mean, there could be multiple chuckles. There could be
multiple chuckles. That's what they call a group of clowns.
Yeah.
A chuckle of clowns.
And wrinkles, wasn't it?
Well, wrinkles.
Yeah, no,
there
wrinkles, yeah.
There could be multiple wrinkles. You'd, kind of people out there in the same costume or something. But also the fact that children, or I guess teenagers, are calling the number and then that person is showing up. To me, that's quite concerning, because I think it's one thing for a parent to call another adult and say, "Oh, come over and spook my child." But for like a group of teenagers to do it and for them to show up, that kind of removes a guardian or parent. And I think there's a real kind of concern there about really this strange adult interacting with young people. It's a bit, I don't know, that's...
It will make for a fascinating documentary, because it struggled to raise its funding, but it did eventually get made, and the trailer for it, I mean, it's fascinating. It's an interesting story I'm keen to hear more about. One last thing I will say before we move on is when I was searching the internet before, looking for like clown stories and scary clowns, someone wrote into Yahoo Questions and wrote, "What should I do if I'm attacked by a group of clowns? Genuinely concerned."
Okay, and the answers were...
most of them just said run.
But they've got those little cars. Those cars can go quite fast, those little... Even if it's just one man in it.
Yeah, and they can pack hundreds of little clowns in them.
Yeah.
But luckily, you can hear them coming because of their squeaky shoes, so...
Yeah, and those shoes don't look like they're built for running either, do they? No. Those giant ones.
And they're all overweight 65-year-old retirees, so you're probably going to be all right outrunning them as well.
Yeah, I think I could outrun a clown.
This is a Spooktator podcast collaboration with the Lancashire Anomalous Phenomena Investigation Society. Best known as LAPIS, the Society are hosting their annual paranormal conference in St Anne's, Lancashire on the 9th and 10th of November. Tickets can be booked at lapisparanormal.com. That's lapisparanormal.com. I'll be delivering a new talk titled The Trials and Tribulations of a Real-Life Ghostbuster. And there are other speakers on a range of fascinating subjects too. One such speaker is the Reverend Peter Laws. Peter is an author, journalist, and YouTube horror host. Among other things, he has written The Frighteners, Why We Love Monsters, Ghosts, Death, and Gore, a book which seeks to explain and defend the lore of the morbid. He recently joined me to discuss why us humans are all a bit creepy deep down. Is it fair to say that you quite enjoy horror stories and movies?
Oh, it's more than fair to say. To be honest, Hayley, I've been into scary things, I think, since birth. I've always been a fan of the spooky and the strange, and I really can't go back to a time when I said, "Oh, I remember watching a film when I was like 8, and it got me into it." It's so ingrained in me, I think. It's just always been with me. I've always been fascinated by the mysterious and the strange, but also the spooky, macabre and scary, and even downright repellent. It's just been this thing about me that, you know, in general life, I've been drawn to those sorts of things. And so naturally, horror films and like ghost stories and all that stuff were just a perfect fit for me.
How do people tend to react when they learn about that?
Well, I mean, it's love of these things is fairly, it's more common than maybe people realize. And so, yes, of course, you occasionally meet somebody who looks at you and says, "Why would you like that sort of stuff?" And maybe we'll kind of back away slowly because they think there's something wrong with you. But maybe it's the circles I move in. But a lot of the people I know really love this sort of stuff too. And you can get a kind of kinship with other horror fans or other fans of spooky things, that sometimes there's a comfort in these topics, I find, and that finding another person who's into these sorts of things can be quite a kind of a moving moment, because there are moments, yes, when you're growing up and you're thinking, "Wow, what's wrong with me? Why am I thinking about these things in such detail?" Especially when I'm really not the type of person who would ever dream of being violent towards anyone. I don't enjoy the idea, you know, when I read a newspaper article about someone who's been killed in a motorway accident or something, I'm not sitting there kind of rubbing my knees going, oh, I love this stuff. There's a very, there's a very clear difference for me between fictionalized stuff or things that have got a bit distance and real life death. And yet it persists in my life. I still am drawn to the topic.
You mentioned there about finding comfort. What do you mean by that? Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I think a lot of us, not necessarily everyone, but I think a lot of us we find ourselves, particularly as adults, in stressful situations. You know, we have mortgages or we have jobs or partners or families and health issues, all these sorts of things that come up. And I do think that us as human beings, we like escapism, and there's nothing wrong with escapism. I think escapism is a really important part of life. And sometimes the place we want to escape to is a place from the past, and where nostalgia comes in. Nostalgia being a really, I think, a key thing for us today. I mean, there's so much kind of retro nostalgia, like a passion for going back to your early years. And so what I find is my kind of comfort that I get from horror is partly to do with it takes me back to those early years as a child or as a teenager before I had mortgages, before I had the stresses of life. And yeah, it actually sort of, it winds me back into a pre-stress state, which for other people would be weird, you know, sitting and watching a werewolf, like, you know, ripping some guy's throat out on a video, on a film. And I'm remembering what it was like watching it on VHS for the first time. So I do think there's kind of interesting nostalgia going on. There's an episode of the Mad Men, the advertising drama, where Don Draper makes a really interesting comment. I haven't checked to see if this is true, but I still liked it as a cool line. He said nostalgia is kind of linked to the word neuralgia, in the sense that it's a pain, and nostalgia is like a pain from an old wound. And I think many of us find ourselves moving back into those kind of formative years because they do bring comfort. I've got friends who, for example, like I've got a friend who suffers from depression, and the way that she deals with that is to watch Harry Potter movies on a loop, even if they're just in the background, because those things were part of her growing up. So yeah, I do think there's lots of other reasons, I think, but that's one of the key reasons for me, is that horror was with me so early on. It's been like a companion for all my life.
Do you think public attitudes to horror have changed?
I personally don't think they've particularly changed, in the sense that there's always been people who are into it, and so always been people who have been disgusted by it. And this has got, you know, goes through, you know, right into kind of early history, where, you know, we've always been drawn to the morbid and macabre. And this is one of the things that kind of is a little bit annoying, when sometimes you'll see people, you know, I don't know, like in newspapers, and saying, oh, the world is so corrupt and we're so debauched now that we have these like torture porn and video games about zombies, and as if we were in the 1950s or in the, you know, the year 500, we're all like, you know, telling each other beautiful stories without any violence. In fact, you know, you just look through the thread of history, and the morbid and macabre have always been a valuable part of our culture. And so, yes, it persists. There's a literary critic called Leslie Fielder who talks about the, you know, the really kind of enduring works of literature from like Beowulf and the Iliad and all these sorts of things, Titus Andronicus. And he says that these things don't kind of continue and survive in our culture because, well, despite of the violence that's in them, but actually probably because of the violence that's in them, because it's always been a topic that's been relevant to us. So yeah, so there's always been people into it and drawn to it. And there remains those people today. I would say, by the way, I would even see like an extremely violent horror film as a form of progress when you compare it to, let's say, the real life death and mayhem of the gladiatorial arenas of Rome, where real people are getting murdered and killed, you know, for entertainment. You know, to look at a video nasty like from the early 80s, people were saying we were going backwards, but actually I think that was progress in the sense that, you know, we were moving on from killing real people. And I do think we're getting better as a society statistically of treating each other a little bit more kindly. You wouldn't think that from looking at the news, but, you know, we're living in an age where more people got education, more people are treated better, or the poverty lines are changing. Anyway, so yes, I do think there's always been people who liked it. But of course, there has always been people who disliked it. And that hasn't changed either. And you will get people campaigning against against horror. You'll get people, particularly from my, you know, in my world, like, because me being a Christian, you will get people from the Christian world, like, campaigning against these things. And even, and also campaigning against people who were interested in the paranormal.
Yes.
And saying you shouldn't be involved in that stuff because it's all demonic, as if it would be normal not to be interested in that stuff, which I find baffling because it's just a fascinating subject no matter what. And so, yeah, you'll get these people who are not into it. And so I don't think it's changed. Yes, these days the people who die with an axe to the head thankfully get paid and get up afterwards, and I think that's good.
Your answer there actually really nicely leads into another question I had a bit further on. I was going to ask that some people suggest that the continual popularity of horror movies and stories and the genre is an indication of moral decline. You mentioned there about nostalgia of the past being safer and so on.
Yeah.
You also, I think in the book, I think you quoted Steven Pinker about how actually violence in human societies continues to decline. And also in the book, you sort of touch upon how horror kind of gets lumped in with dangerous and violent video games and so on.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that there's this assumption that these sorts of interests are going to corrupt and warp people. But I do think that, like, video games is a good example. I mean, I really enjoy playing, you know, scary video games too. And I know that in our society, there's this kind of knee-jerk reaction to those games and say, oh, well, that's going to cause people to be, you know, extremely violent. And then people make this kind of, I would say, not a very informed equation between, say, school shooters and the fact that they're playing, you know, shoot 'em ups on their video games. However, actually, if you were to chart the life of video games from, say, the late 70s and up until now, when even in the late 70s, there were really some sort of violent arcade games, you know, games in which you would drive your little digitized car and run people down on the pavements. And at the time, it was like, this is going to make people kill people. And actually, that's not an illogical instinct. It's like, you know, that would make sense. But if you look statistically and you look back over the lifespan of violent video games, what do you see? You actually see youth violence starting to decline. Now, I find this very fascinating because really it should have exploded because the video game industry is absolutely massive and we have just so much access to this stuff. And again, and also the horror movie industry, if you look at horror movies today, they are way more explicit today than they ever were. I mean, I remember when I was in, you know, like 10 or 11 or whatever, and I would go to the video shop, you know, when I was watching on VHS in those days, and the guy would sometimes say behind the counter, oh, this video's been banned, Peter, but I'll let you get it. That's probably why I'm such a weirdo today. But when you watch those videos now, those films now, they're so tame compared to even, like, you know, TV shows. If you look at things like The Walking Dead or Hannibal or Game of Thrones, all these other just pretty mainstream fare, there's a lot of gore in them. So you'd think, therefore, because the fictionalized gore and the digitized gore in video games have exploded, then really we would be seeing people murdering one another left, right, and center, particularly young people who are big audiences for this. You see actually the opposite. You see a decline. And that is something that isn't always reported because I think it goes against our instincts. We take a lazy approach and think the things we watch we're so kind of one-dimensional that we watch something and we're going to want to recreate that. I just don't think that's how our minds work. I think we're more complicated than that. I think we look at scary things and horror things sometimes to help us cope with the scary things of this world, not to replicate them.
Now, in the book, you mentioned that wonderful piece of research by Professor Bruce Hood involving a cardigan that people are told belonged to the murderer Fred West. The research, for listeners who don't know, the research basically gauges whether knowing this will stop people from trying it on even for a reward. My question is, would you put the cardigan on?
I think my rational brain says, just put it on, you know, put it on, take a selfie with it, and then you'll remember that you were the one who wore it. That's my rational brain would say that. But I have plenty of kind of open-mindedness to, I suppose, what you could call magical thinking, or just a not wanting to associate with things or promote things that really hurt people. And so, to be honest, no, I wouldn't put it on. I wouldn't put it on because I just don't like the idea of it. You know, this guy and his wife murdered and tortured and raped so many people. So I'm not really into the idea of wearing it, but it's different from maybe some people who'll think if I wear this, I'm somehow going to be connected with this killer. And that's what's really interesting about that study that he does, is that he's saying that when it comes to items belonging to, you know, savage killers like this, people do develop almost like a magical thinking, where objects become enchanted or like toxic, or, you know, you see it with celebrities. Like if I was to say, oh, I don't know, Kim Kardashian, like, drunk out of this glass. And then I could potentially sell that glass to someone else. If I could prove it was Kim Kardashian, had a photo, someone would buy that glass. It's just a glass, but somehow they think their persona is connected with the glass. And it's the same thing with objects like, you know, Nazi helmets. Mm. People won't put those on. Yeah. There's been, you know, there's things like when I've seen experiments where they've baked like a cake or something, like a chocolate mousse, and they've shaped it like a dog turd. And people are just like, I'm not eating that, because our mind associates things with that. Because, for example, my wife and I once were just, you know, looking through the newspaper, and it said that the flat of Dennis Nielsen had come up for sale, which was a kind of infamous serial killer in the 80s. And anyway, his place was for sale, and apparently it was for sale for a fair bit less than it would normally be because, you know, a bunch of people were tortured and killed in there. I remember talking to my wife and saying, like, yeah, I wouldn't want to live there. I don't like the association of feeling like I'm in a place that where tragedy has happened. Where she said, yeah, but it's so much cheaper, I would. And I do think it depends on your brain. Like, if you're the type who makes these connections and feels uncomfortable, or if you can shut them off. I suppose I can't shut them off. And so the short answer is, I wouldn't wear the cardigan.
It's interesting you touched upon the Dennis Nielsen flat, because we spoke about that in a very recent episode. We were actually talking about how in, I think it's Hong Kong, they have these houses in which people have died, or there's been attempted murder or violence or something like that belong to a cult, for example. And there is this tradition where those houses are priced a lot cheaper than other real estate. And the younger generations seem to be buying them up more than the older generations. And we were discussing whether or not we would live in a house in which somebody had died, and then the Dennis Nielsen thing came up. And it is really interesting how people make those judgment calls. There doesn't really seem to be much rational thought in them, even though people might consider themselves to be rational people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do wonder that maybe that's interesting, that the younger generation were potentially more attracted to move in somewhere like that. That's interesting, because it makes me wonder if that's a reflection of kind of paranormal interest in general that is sort of big these days, particularly amongst younger people who live in a world that is in some sense kind of unenchanted, you know, like the kind of relentless rational worldview, which, you know, if you're an atheist, and, you know, I write a series of novels, that's what I'm mainly known for, in which the main character is an atheist. You know, for him, the world is beautiful in its rationality. So there's nothing wrong with seeing the world in purely rational terms. However, for some people, they kind of miss that sense of other dimension. And I wonder if, you know, those people, those young people, like, find that attractive, the idea of living in a house that could have a connection with the thin place between life and death. Or, of course, they might just get a kick out of the idea. Or they might be just, you know, so priced out of the market, they're just desperate to get a cheap house.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I find it fascinating. I'd love for someone to do more research into that. Now, we've established that liking horror doesn't mean there's something wrong with people generally, but do you think there are boundaries that can be crossed when it comes to the appreciation of this genre?
I suppose I have personal boundaries, although my boundaries are maybe further along than some people would think. But yes, there's certain types of violence, for example, when I'm watching a film that I just don't like. And, you know, I guess it's the traditional ones, but I don't like sexualized violence. Watching that on screen can make me feel a bit queasy and unsettled. And also, you know, violence against children can sometimes creep me out a bit. But that I don't think that means that I'm the type of guy who says, so therefore we should never explore these topics in film.
Sure, yeah.
Or in fiction. I mean, these things do happen. I do think art is an important way of us getting to grips with those things. I'd struggle to say there's certain things that should be banned. I mean, obviously, I'd say you should ban anything that hurts another person. So, like, I'm not snuff movies or pedophilia type films or whatever, or child porn. That's what I'm thinking of. That all of that sort of stuff. Couldn't remember the word there. All of that sort of stuff. Obviously, there's a barrier. As soon as you cross the barrier when someone else is actually getting hurt or exploited, that to me is just completely wrong. So you stop that. But in art and kind of drama, I think it is supposed to explore everything in one way or another within, you know, the grounds of taste, but also sometimes, like, you know, I remember watching The Accused, the film with Jodie Foster in it, where she is raped. And I just watched that. I was just so traumatized by that and the thought of it. But that was a good thing. Because at the end of it, it just, as a teenager watching that, made me just think, oh my goodness, this should not ever, ever happen to any woman ever. So the brutality of that kind of worked, as it were.
For The Frighteners, you did a lot of on-the-ground weird research. And I say weird, and that's coming from someone who's a paranormal researcher. So that's from Hunting for a Werewolf, a Hunting Ghost, meeting real-life vampires, and so on. Were there any standout experiences for you during that period?
I mean, it was a wonderful book to research, and particularly traveling to Transylvania and spending time there was like a kind of a bit of a childhood dream come true, really, because I always wanted to go there ever since I was a little boy. So that's a standout memory from writing that book. But I do think it was meeting the people, the unusual people, who were just on the surface really bizarre. And yet I just really, my heart just connected with these people. I think the fact that, you know, I'm also a ordained minister, church minister, that, like, I can't help but have that kind of pastoral vibe going as well. And I do get annoyed when people are just pushed to the side in society and thought of as, you know, you're weird or you're a freak, and so therefore let's dismiss you. That just makes me uncomfortable. I think probably because I feel like a freak, to be honest. And it can, you know, with my interests, and that can make you quite lonely. And so you have a kinship with other people who are freaks too. And so I think one of the standout things from that book were meeting people who, yes, were a little bit on the unusual side, like a guy I went for a werewolf hunt with who slept on a mortuary slab one night because he had a diagnosis about him potentially dying. And the way he faced that was to lie on a slab. These sorts of people, I guess people could laugh at them or think, like, what's wrong with them? But me, I just thought, that's really interesting. And it draws me to these people to understand them. Mm-hmm. But there were also just other, I mean, they were cool. There were some cool things in that, like being chased by zombies through an underground nuclear bunker in Essex was absolutely awesome. I loved that night. The BBC took me to a kind of weird old mansion in the middle of nowhere and did creepy, weird things to me and a bunch of other people that for one night. That was, I'll never forget that. So yeah, loads of cool stuff.
Finally, you're going to be speaking at the Lapis conference in November.
Yeah.
Can you maybe just briefly outline what your talk's going to be about?
Yeah, I mean, they've asked me specifically to talk about my book, The Frighteners, Why We Love Monsters, Ghosts, Death and Gore. And so I'm going to be outlining and expanding perhaps on some of the stuff that we've been talking about here and explaining a little bit about not only how popular the morbid streak is, but also trying to defend it and to help people understand that it is a natural part of human existence. And so, we're going to be exploring that on the day, but I'm going to be around for the whole time and for the whole conference. And so it'd be great to meet with people and to chat through all of these topics. And I would point out as well, sometimes people think, here you're a church minister and they think you're going to turn up at these things to try and kind of convert people away from the dark side. because sadly, so many people, particularly in the paranormal community, their experiences of Christians have just been, you know, stop watching ghost hunters and what's, you know, get away from that stuff and put, burn your tarot cards and all this sort of stuff. And that's just not where I'm coming from. I find this stuff fascinating. I'm on a similar journey to everyone else just in this mysterious world. So yeah, if you see the word reverend on the program, you know, don't worry. I'm not going to be there to cast demons out. I'm probably just there to talk about demons because they're interesting.
And if people want to learn more about your writing and the things that you're doing, where can they find more information?
You can go to peterlaws.co.uk or you can follow me on Twitter at RevPeterLaws and Instagram at RevPeterLaws. And on YouTube, I have a channel called The Flicks That Church Forgot, or if you look for Peter Laws, you'll find it. And my books are available in bookshops. The Frighteners is in hardback and paperback and audiobook and ebook, and also my three novels, fourth one's coming out soon. They're all in kind of shops and stuff now. So yeah, that's me.
That was Peter Laws, who will be appearing at the Lapis Paranormal Conference on the 9th and 10th of November. Tickets for the event can be booked at lapisparanormal.com. That's lapisparanormal.com. I'll see you there. Recently, there have been a flurry of headlines proclaiming that scientists have discovered that the Loch Ness Monster is, in fact, an eel. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but there has been a press conference by the scientists who've been doing research at Loch Ness, where they've taken samples of the water to test it for the DNA in the water so that they can work out what animals basically are in and around the water. I've seen mixed reactions to this because some people, a lot of my skeptical friends, have shared the story by saying, look, see, this is proof that the Loch Ness Monster is just nonsense, that it's just maybe a naturally occurring creature. This eel is, or eels, that could be the cause of what people are seeing. And then other people, largely a lot of my skeptical friends, but also largely the paranormal community, have kind of responded by saying, what the hell are you talking about? This makes no sense whatsoever. And I kind of fall into that group because I find the idea that eels could explain away the plethora of sightings of the Loch Ness Monster kind of almost patronizingly simple, really, very simplistic. It should be pointed out that the CFZ, the Centre for 14 Zoology, based here in the UK, have long said that they believe that a lot of monster sightings at Loch Ness and also at Windermere, where people say there's a lake monster called Bonessie, they believe that a cause for these could be eels, or what they've dubbed super eels, which are eels that do not migrate away to...
So what makes them super if they just stay where they are?
Because they're big.
Yeah, they get super-sized, big. I guess.
In that case, I'm super poor because I stay here and I'm fat.
Wow, self-owned. So this guy, Professor Neil Gemmell, I believe his name is, I think that's how it's pronounced, led a team in examining the DNA in the water of Loch Ness. And the real kind of research reason they did this research was to explore the biodiversity of the loch. And they used the always headline worthy story of the lake monster to gain press attention for their research, really. I guess if they had just done a press conference to say, oh, we've done some research on the biodiversity of the Loch Ness, probably wouldn't really get that much of a response. But by saying, we've been doing some DNA testing on the Loch Ness monster, obviously that then generates a flurry of press, especially in the kind of tourist months, you know, August and so on. But the team, they were quite honest about this at the press conference, and Gemmell told the gathered reporters, we've been talking about science the entire time and we're using the monster as bait. I came into this with the view that there probably wasn't a monster. I wanted to understand the biodiversity of the Loch Ness, and we've done that very well. And The Guardian, writing on this, go on to report that Gemmell said the sheer volume of eel DNA surprised him and his team. And maintaining a straight face, he added, "We don't know if the eel DNA we're detecting is from a gigantic eel or just many small eels." Which, this is kind of where it lost me a bit, because I can appreciate somebody going and testing the biodiversity of Loch Ness. I understand why you would want to do that. It's an interesting way of gaining insight into that area and the animals that are using it and living there and so on. And also, it does provide some insight into what might be causing sightings of the Loch Ness Monster. I mean, in a previous episode, we discussed the sighting, which I think was caught on camera, which turned out to be caused by a tree stump in the water.
Yes.
And we know that other sightings have been explained away by deer crossing the loch and their neck and their sticking out of the water being mistaken as something more monstrous. We know that people see wildlife in the loch all the time and birds landing on the water and mistake them for monsters and so on. So being able to have a look at the biodiversity of the loch based on the DNA would actually provide some really interesting insight. But for them to have focused on the eel DNA and associating it with the monster, to me, is just absolutely absurd. I'm not really sure how they can go from saying we've got all of these interesting animals that are potentially using the loch, we've got the DNA to support them, oh, and we think the eels could be the monster. There's just absolutely no scientific basis for that.
It seems more like when a health food company tries to put like Super Mario on its cover to make kids eat it. It just feels like it's that kind of angle, you know?
Yeah.
I suppose it depends on kind of in what context it was actually said, because there is always, if you're doing like a press release, you know that people are going to ask about the monster, obviously. So you'd say like, yeah, of these findings that were of this profile we've done of the loch, what do you think would be the most reasonable one to explain the Loch Ness Monster? But it's a false premise as well, because as you said, there probably is no one explanation for it. You know, the idea they've all been eels. It's like, well, maybe some of them have been eels and some of them have been cormorants, some of them have been logs, some of them have been deer. There have been all kinds of different things. So just saying that this is the culprit is probably a bit false, really.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Why don't we just make a real Loch Ness Monster? Don't we have the genetics? Can't we just slap a bunch of lizard and crocodile and eel genes together and put a real Loch Ness Monster in there?
Didn't someone try that and make the platypus?
Yes, but isn't it just like, just because you could, you never stop to think if you should?
Hey, look, those Jurassic Parks turned out to be flawless with no problems at all.
Those are alternative facts, Paul, and you know it.
I'm just saying we should put a real Loch Ness Monster in there. We may as well at this point.
What do you mean, put one in there? There already is one.
No, there's not. Look, it's like Santa Claus. There used to be, but like he passed on a long time ago, so it's just a lot of friends helping him out. It's just...
So where's the body?
The body was eaten by King Henry VIII. It's like you don't know the facts sometimes. It's really weird.
I love that. Of course it was. I did know that, actually.
Or put a big Jim Henson animatronic one in that, you know, goes on a rail and pops out every now and then and says, ho, 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 Merry Christmas. Something like that.
I mean, it would work as a tourist attraction.
Bloody would.
Yeah.
Yeah, true. You could get sponsorship from Haribo.
Yeah. They
had the Loch Ness Monster in the advert recently. Yeah. So Professor Gemmell is quoted, he says, "There's no shark DNA in Loch Ness based on our sampling. There's also no catfish DNA in Loch Ness based on our sampling. We can't find any evidence of sturgeon either. There is a very significant amount of eel DNA. Eels are very plentiful in Loch Ness. With eel DNA found at pretty much every location sampled, there are a lot of them. So are they giant eels? Well, our data doesn't reveal their size, but the sheer quantity of the material says that we can't discount the possibility that there may be giant eels in Loch Ness. Therefore, we can't discount the possibility that what people see and believe in the Loch Ness Monster might be a giant eel." And what I think is quite interesting, I think what's happened here is that he has said, we can't discount the possibility. And the media have gone, they can't discount the possibility. They can't, oh, that means that it must be giant eels. And people have really run with this one. And it's absolutely bizarre.
It probably was a bit irresponsible in retrospect of them actually doing it at Loch Ness in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
because you probably could have tested out any large body of water, but presumably they knew what they were doing. And a certain amount of funding comes from a certain amount of public interest in what you're doing.
But also that a giant eel could maybe be mistaken for a lake monster. I mean, yeah, I can understand that. The European eel can apparently reach lengths of about 4 to 5 foot in length in exceptional cases, but are normally about 60 centimetres long, which is about 2 foot.
Yeah, and very impressive.
Rarely more than 3 foot in length, which you can get fish bigger than that. So if there was going to be a culprit, you would imagine it would be fish that are being mistaken as a monster rather than an eel. Though I understand the eel kind of looks like the Loch Ness Monster is supposed to be long and so on. But yeah, this is a really weird story, and I just feel like it's important to point out that the Loch Ness Monster probably isn't an eel, and we can all calm down.
Okay.
I think it's a dog with a hat on.
Oh, apparently DNA from dogs was found.
I'm not surprised at all. There must be like a quite a significant, because when you think about all the different animals going in the loch, dogs are actually really quite a sizable one.
Mm. Yeah, so there was DNA from humans, dogs, sheep, cows, deer, badgers, rabbits, voles, and birds as well, as other animals.
So what they found in the lake is everything that's on the land around it then, basically.
So this has been another episode of the Spooktator podcast. Remember, you can find links to everything we've discussed at spooktator.co.uk, where you can also find links to our social media accounts and the different ways you can subscribe to the show. Remember, we are now on Spotify, so you can follow and listen to us on there if you would like. We'll be back soon with another episode. Until then, remember, spooky is in the eye of the beholder.